06.
I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Under the Affordable Care Act, most employers who provide health benefits for their employees must include contraception. Religious organizations, and institutions are exempt or they're given a workaround. The owners of two for-profit companies, Hobby Lobby and Conestoga Wood Specialties, are challenging this provision in the law, claiming it violates the religious beliefs of the owners. The U.S. Supreme Court will hear arguments in these cases next year, and at issue is whether businesses have religious rights just like people do. It's going to set an important precedent no matter what the court decides. We have two guests who have joined us to talk about what these cases involve, what's at stake when it comes to the issue of religious freedom, and the possibility of the wide-ranging impact no matter what the court decides. Dahlia Lithwick writes about the courts and the law for Slate. And Dahlia, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
Also with us is David Skeel, professor of corporate law at the University of Pennsylvania, currently a visiting professor at NYU School of Law. And David, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for me as well.
Dahlia, let me begin with you. Is it appropriate for the Supreme Court to take these cases because the two lower courts came to entirely different conclusions?
I think not only appropriate, but almost, I would say, urgent. I think when you have, it's not just two lower appeals courts. You have actually a bunch of lower appeals courts, and then you also have 80 other challenges teed up behind it. So you've got, two federal circuit courts that uphold this provision, two that strike it down, the D.C. Circuit Court, which for different reasons says that this is, in fact, a violation of religious freedom. So you've got a complete hodgepodge of decisions just in the lower appeals courts alone. And so basically the law is completely unsettled around the country. Over and above that, I think it's just an issue of such pressing constitutional concern that there was no way the court could have sidestepped.
And picking up on the hodgepodge idea, David, is it possible for this court to bring some clarity to this issue no matter what they decide?
I think it is. I think it's going to end up being somewhat messy whichever way it gets decided, as religious freedom issues often tend to be. But I think the court can bring a significant amount of clarity to the issue.
What's at stake here? Let me hear from you first, David.
Well, what is it at stake? I mean, the first question is of what is at stake is simply how we interpret the First Amendment and RFRA, the statute that's intended in some context to extend the First Amendment extend the Supreme Court's interpretation of the First Amendment. So one thing that's at stake is simply how we make sense of these provisions. The other more practical thing that's at stake, it seems to me, is how we think about associations in this country and different kinds of associations. Are nonprofit corporations different from for-profit corporations? What kinds of associations are given what kinds of protection? So to me, that's really the big issue that's at stake.
Let me go back to you, Dahlia. And RFRA stands for the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. What do you see as being at stake in this case before the U.S. Supreme Court?
I think that's exactly it. I think it's an absolute collision between basic claims of religious freedom and religious liberty as protected under the First Amendment, as David says, or as protected under RFRA. So these are two corporations owned by very explicitly religious families. These families hold themselves out as, you know, religious entities, and they, although they own for-profit secular corporations, they say, no, we run them in a religious fashion. So I think, you know, we need to stipulate that these are deeply held religious convictions on the one hand. And then on the other hand, we have a law that the administration passes that says, we think there's a compelling interest in making sure that women have preventive health care. And in that, we include birth control. We think these are urgent matters. And the real question is, can religious owners of for-profit corporations say, this isn't just my religion, it's the corporation's religion that is violating violated by providing something that violates my religious faith. So it is a profound, profound collision of religious freedoms on the one hand and just basic, entitlement to neutral laws on the other hand. So it's a huge, huge question that I don't think gets sorted out cleanly.
David, I want to go back to you, but just one clarification here, Dolly, and I've seen this a number of times, talking about these being secular organizations run by people who have deeply felt religious beliefs. What is meant by a secular organization?
Well, just that they're for-profit companies.
Okay.
The administration had already exempted, for instance, Catholic hospitals, Catholic universities, right? So those were already exempted from these constraints. The question was, when you have a company that doesn't exactly purport to be religious, right? Hobby Lobby is a craft store. Conestoga, the other one, is a custom cabinetry company. So they don't purport to be explicitly religious, and they are clearly for profit, but they run their companies, they say, according to their religious dictates. For instance, Hobby Lobby is closed on Sunday. So it's very amorphous.
Going back to you, David Skeel, I mean, if they made crosses or church pews or rosaries, would we be having a different conversation, even if it were a for-profit company like that?
I think we'd be having the same conversation. And one thing that I'd like to add to what we've said so far, it seems to me that there are two different issues that have to be resolved to decide whether these firms need to comply with the contraception mandate. The first is whether a for-profit corporation can have religious freedom. And as you know, my view is the correct view is ought to be yes on that. The second question is, how do we reconcile the religious freedom with Obamacare? And it's quite possible on the second question you would conclude that even though corporations may have religious freedom under some circumstances, that religious freedom does not allow them to ignore the dictates of Obamacare. And there is Supreme Court case law on that from about 30 years ago in the particular issue in that context with Social Security. And the court said an Amish employer that had very strong religious views, and they were sincerely held, nevertheless had to comply with the Social Security obligations that businesses have. So it seems to me that there are two separate issues there, and I don't think that the exact nature of the business, whether it's making crosses or whether it's making cabinets, changes that first issue of whether a corporation can, under some circumstances, have religious freedom rights.
Dahlia, why is it always about contraception?
Well, one of the things that's interesting in these cases is it's not even necessarily about the same types of contraception, Marty. So, you know, when you look at the various companies that have sued under the contraception mandate, some object to all forms of birth control, some object to just, Plan B, which is the morning after pill, some object to something called Ella, which is what we call the week after pill. So, even as between the various plaintiffs in these suits, there isn't even agreement about what do we mean when we say something causes abortion. And I think that really shores up the idea that different faiths come to very different conclusions about that. So already, simply as amongst the two cases that the court has taken, there isn't even agreement amongst the two plaintiffs about what it is specifically under the birth control mandate that their religion objects to. And I think it really does come down to the religious definition of when life begins, right? Is it the minute a sperm fertilizes an egg? Is it something else? What precisely these drugs do is very much in contention among different religions. And so you really have this kind of slippery slope of different faiths taking different positions about when life begins, and then they go on and say, I'm going to agree to provide insurance for X, Y, and Z, but not A and B, or not A, or not C. And it's very, very fraught because these are issues of faith.
Well, and let me just throw out another scenario for you, Dolly, and David, I'd like to hear from you as well, because let's say you work for someone who's a Christian Scientist or someone who's a Jehovah's Witness. They don't believe in transfusions. They don't believe in, you know, they believe prayer is the solution for a lot of medical problems, or perhaps even don't believe in vaccines. Is that the slippery slope that worries you, Dahlia?
Well, it is a slippery slope that worries me. It's one of the slippery slope that one of the dissenting judges in one of the appeals court cases lays out. This is Judge Rovner, and her dissent in one of the cases lays out exactly the sort of parade of horribles that you, posit there. And she says, listen, you know, imagine a Methodist employer who simply refuses to pay for any stem cell trials for an employee. Imagine a Christian Scientist employer who simply won't ever cover any traditional medical approaches. Are we going to sort of throw open the floodgates for any employer to claim that their faith prevents them from providing certain types of insurance? And I think, you know, the legal term for this is a limiting principle, right? Mm-hmm. Where do you stop the possibility that this is going to happen everywhere? And I think one of the things that's really tricky in these cases is that it's hard to know where the limiting principle is between birth control and abortion, and between the faith of a Christian Scientist, the deeply held faith of a Christian Scientist, and that of a Jehovah's Witness and that of a Catholic.
David, do you see the same slippery slope?
I probably see the effects of the slippery slope a little bit differently, but I do completely agree that there are line-drawing issues. I mean, I think the Jehovah's Witnesses case would probably be an easy case on the principle that your religious views can't completely interfere with the governmental framework that's been put in place, that they're conflicting directly with the objective of the healthcare law. So I don't think that particular case would be a problem, but I do think there are real line drawing issues, and unfortunately we get these line drawing issues in many religious freedom contexts. I think it's the nature of the beast to a certain extent.
But we are talking, though, about, if we're talking about the Affordable Care Act, David, about a minute before our first break here, part of the Affordable Care Act is contraception that's been approved by the FDA.
That's correct. I'm not sure exactly where you're going.
Well,
with that.
Well, I mean, if you have a government entity, I guess, you know, saying that this is preventative care, this is health care, can a company sort of tease out bits and pieces of that for their employees?
Well, I think that's the line drawing that we would have to do. It seems to me that limited having issues with a couple of forms of contraception is probably on the other end of the scale from not permitting any medical intervention at all, or very limited medical intervention. Contraception generally, the Catholic position on these issues, being resistant to providing any contraception, strikes me as being kind of in the middle. So I do think it's a spectrum. I think the easy case on one side is the Jehovah's Witness case. I don't think a court would allow a Jehovah's Witness-oriented corporation to refuse to provide any medical intervention.
And hold on to that thought, only because we're up on a very short break. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Support for WHYY comes from Delaware Valley College. Delaware Valley College offers a Master of Arts in Policy Studies that prepares students to take leadership roles in developing policies to address important issues impacting our communities. Students can choose from food and agriculture, sustainability and environment, or community and international development. More information about a Master of Arts in Policy Studies is available online at delval.edu/grad. As the calendar pages fall away and 2013 comes to an end, you might be thinking of how to get that last-minute tax deduction. Whether you make a sustaining gift, have your employer match your gift, donate your car, or make a direct IRA rollover to WHYY, time is running out to make a tax-deductible donation. Explore the many ways to support WHYY. Call 1-888-345-WHYY or visit whyy.org/support.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, a company monitors social media of students for schools. They say it's not a violation of privacy, it's for security.
We've given access to kids to a much more dangerous vehicle than an automobile, and we've given them no guidance, no governance.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Can a business refuse to provide health insurance that covers contraception because of the religious beliefs of the owners? Does a for-profit company have religious rights and freedoms just as people do? These are some of the questions the U.S. Supreme Court will be hearing next year. We're talking about these particular cases and what it all means with David Scheele, professor of corporate law at the University of Pennsylvania, and with Dahlia Lithwick, who writes about law and the courts for Slate. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Dahlia, let me go back to you. Does Citizens United give us any guidance in understanding where this issue stands today?
I'm sorry, was that for me?
Yes, it was for you, Dahlia. I'm sorry, go ahead. Yes, Dahlia.
Yeah, you know, it does in so far as at least the Hobby Lobby judge who wrote the opinion, the majority opinion in the Hobby Lobby case quite explicitly said, if we think that corporations have this panoply of rights after Citizens United, including speech rights, I can't really find a reason to distinguish religious rights as well. So in some of these cases, the courts quite explicitly say, you know, if corporations are more or less persons for the purposes of, you know, political campaign contributions, then I don't understand why that wouldn't extend to religious freedom. And it's important here to also just be very, very crisp, which we haven't been exactly. The claims, the First Amendment claims, right, under the religious freedom provisions of the First Amendment are only part of this case. RFRA, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, quite explicitly says that it applies to people, not to things that are not people. And so this question really arises in force when you look at the Religious Freedom Restoration Act claims, because so far the court hasn't said that for RFRA purposes, people get to be defined as anything beyond people.
You want to weigh in on that, David, the speech rights, religious rights issue?
I think that Dahlia has laid it out really nicely. If you look at the language of the First Amendment, with which the majority in Citizens United relied on fairly heavily, it says Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. So it doesn't say anything about the individual or entity that would be exercising the rights, and the Supreme Court said that suggests that that corporations as well as individuals can be included. As Dahlia said, RFRA talks about people. It says government shall not burden a person's exercise of religion. And so with RFRA, it's a much trickier issue in my view. In my view, the court is likely to conclude a person can include a corporation for the simple reason that we have many laws that interpret person to include a corporation. The bankruptcy laws, for instance, interpret person to be individual, partnership, or corporation. But it's not a no-brainer. I think that could go either way, because many people, when they hear the word person, think individual, not corporation.
You want to weigh in on that, Dahlia? And I'm thinking about, I mean, there are owners of these companies or corporations, and then there is the company or the corporations themselves. Do we think of them in two different categories?
It's so difficult when you're talking about religion. I mean, in many, many ways, these are easier cases when you're talking about speech, because as David says, there's a little bit of a, you know, a logical, you can import the idea of personhood to corporate speech in a way that's much easier than when you're talking about religion. If you look at the Conestoga case, for instance, that's the woodworking company in Pennsylvania, the judge who wrote that opinion saying, oh my God, of course the corporations are not people for religion purposes. And there's just a lot of language in that opinion that says, you know, corporations don't have faith. They don't believe. It's one thing to say that the owners have faith, and we can stipulate that owners have deeply held faith, but corporations don't go to church, and corporations don't go to heaven. So, you know, to suggest that that same notion can be imported onto faith is really, really tricky for some of the judges who look at these cases.
I'd be curious about your response, David.
So I agree that it's tricky, but I found that the judge's statement about corporations not worshiping or going to church, or in the famous old saying, there's no body to kick, no soul to damn, not all that helpful, because the religions, the churches that everybody agrees are protected under the First Amendment and under RFRA, are their corporations too. Most churches are set up for legal purposes as corporations. So if we say a corporation can't hold views and can't have beliefs, what we need to be saying to reach that conclusion is that includes churches, or the opposite possibility is that there is something different about either nonprofit corporations or religious corporations as compared to secular corporations.
But it sounds like you're saying that sort of for accepted, I guess, mainstream religions, there is some body of law that says that they have some religious rights. But I'm thinking about, you know, the less mainstream religions that say we're a religion too.
Well, I don't think that necessarily maps onto the corporation versus not corporation. No matter how non-mainstream your religion is, if you want legal protections, you will probably incorporate it. And there is a form in the law that is designed for religious corporations to use. Now, if you have a non-mainstream religion that has not taken advantage of that form, you may have a separate set of issues. But my main point is, when we say that corporations can't worship, surely we're not saying that worship isn't relevant to a church that happens to be a corporation for legal purposes.
What do you think, Dahlia?
Well, two thoughts. One is just a piece of sort of historic irony here, is that when RFRA was drafted, right, RFRA was drafted in response to a Supreme Court opinion written, of all people, by Justice Antonin Scalia.
That's right.
More or less saying, you know, that you can't use your religious conscience or conviction when you want to question the application of just laws of general applicability, right? So this was people who were smoking peyote as part of Native American worship, and Scalia says, hey, you know what, neutral drug laws apply to everybody. You don't get to override them and claim it's a religious freedom claim. So one thing that's interesting is that RFRA is actually born, it's meant to give teeth to First Amendment religious freedoms, but it's actually, the intention of RFRA originally was to protect unpopular minority, sort of small, sidelined religions. And so one of the paradoxes of this case is that very, very powerful religious faiths are being protected. But the other thing that I think is just worth flagging is that the court has been pretty clear that, and you know, the language in at least the court doctrine is, when followers of a particular sect enter into commercial activity as a matter of choice, they cannot then superimpose their choices on, you know, regular, normal statutory schemes. So the court is pretty careful to say, look, it's one thing to be a Catholic hospital. It's one thing to be a Catholic university. But when you just become a corporation, you want to avail yourselves of the legal protections of incorporation, that's something different. And so I think, you know, David and I are sort of talking along the seam of an argument here about when you cross into right. becoming just a purely commercial, corporate, nonprofit enterprise. And it's very, very tricky, as I said, in these cases, because these companies hold themselves out to be more than just Christians who incorporated to make craft products.
Well, and we've been largely focusing on the employer part of this. But David, do employees have religious rights under these circumstances we've been talking about?
They would have religious rights, but the religious rights would be different from the corporation's religious rights if the corporation has religious rights. And I think that's very important to these cases, because what I would fear would happen if the court were to conclude that corporations don't have or can't have religious freedom rights, what I would be afraid would happen is that the lower courts, some of them at least, would start figuring out ways to conclude that employees or the people running these businesses have their own individual religious freedom rights, and they're being interfered with. And Dahlia referred earlier to the Washington, D.C., the district, the D.C. Court of Appeals opinion, which did something like that. It said there's no religious freedom rights for corporations, but these individuals have religious freedom rights, and their religious freedom rights have been interfered with. I think that would be a complete mess. So I think it's very important to keep the corporate rights, if they exist, separate from the individual rights.
And that's David Skeel. He's a professor of corporate law at the University of Pennsylvania, currently a visiting professor at New York University School of Law. Dahlia Lithwick is with us as well. She writes about the courts and the law for Slate. And we have just one or two open lines at 1-888-477-9499. Dahlia, did you want to respond to something David just said there?
I do, because I think one of the questions you ask is, in fact, one of the questions that the court's going to have to contend with, and that is the question of what about these employees? So it's not simply do they have religious rights that are being kind of plowed over by their employers' religious rights. And I do think that's part of it. I mean, I certainly think the framers who crafted the First Amendment because they had a horror of the government telling people that religion prevents them from doing X or Y. I think the framers would have been equally horrified by the idea of your employer doing the same thing. But I think that there is one of the questions that the court is going to have to deal with in this case is, even if they say, you know what, corporations have religious freedom rights, and for First Amendment and RFRA purposes, corporations are people too, they still have to answer this question: is there a compelling government interest under RFRA in nevertheless providing birth control to American workers? And the Obama administration has been pretty clear that 99% of American women have used birth control at some point in their lives. 27 million women are now covered under the ACA in ways that they weren't. Birth control is unbelievably expensive. And the Obama administration says, look, this is just a question of treating women and men equally. If women have prohibitive costs in obtaining birth control, and if women cannot get birth control, that affects the labor market. That affects their ability to be equal economic actors with men. And so the administration takes a pretty strong position to say, this isn't just, you know, some convenience that we're giving women so that they can, you know, get access to something for free that they should pay for. They really think there is a compelling government interest as part of preventive care. That's one other thing I should add, that most women most of the time use birth control for reasons other than birth control. There's all sorts of medical reasons that women need birth control for health reasons. So the administration really takes the posture, this is preventive care, and it is preventive care that we need to offer to women and men equally in order to create equality. And the court has long said that creating of gender equality is a compelling government interest.
Let me get some callers in on the conversation. Looks like we have Diane from Newtown joining us. Diane, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning. I'm wondering if companies like Hobby Lobby are providing any kind of extended maternity leave or maternity care that goes along with these same claims of doing this for religious reasons. Are they backing that up with other services or coverage for their employees?
I don't know if, David, just for equal time here, is there anything you can say in response to Diane's question?
Nothing other than I think it's a great question. I don't know specifically what Hobby Lobby does, but I do think that's a very interesting question.
Because what? It raises questions about consistency?
Yeah, I don't think it affects the legal issue in any direct way, but I think it does. Well, I mean, it could in that sense. I mean, it affects the issue of how do we feel about what companies are doing when they claim religious exemptions. It could affect the legal issue, I guess, in a way, to the extent that it goes to the question whether this corporation really is operating on religious principles. And I think that's a really important issue. We've been talking a lot about the general question of whether for-profit corporations can have religious freedom rights, but there's also the question of if they can, how would they show that?
Right.
And I think the showing ought to be pretty high, such as something in your certificate of incorporation saying we are operating on biblical principles or some other set of principles.
A sincerity test of some sort, David?
but I actually think it's easier with a corporation, because particularly with a big corporation, the fact that your CEO happens to be religious would not pass muster. Mm. If there's nothing in your certificate of incorporation, nothing in your bylaws, nothing in your corporate documents that says we are operating according to a set of religious principles or a set of environmental principles. So I actually think there's a little bit of a be careful what you wish for component of this. If the court were to say corporations do have religious freedom rights, I think the number of corporations that would be able to take advantage of that would be relatively small.
And Dahlia, does it raise questions more than just closing on Sunday, or perhaps, as I understand, in Hobby Lobby, they play religious music, you know, as people are shopping? Is it asking a company or corporation, from a Diane's perspective, to be more overt about the kind of care that they do provide for their employees?
I think that you know, that's exactly the problem you're going to get into, and I think David said it really eloquently. You know, do you want to get into a situation where courts are going to be scrutinizing, you know, the genuineness of religious liberty claims? And one of the cases that the court didn't take was a challenge from Eden Foods, a health food company. In part, I think the reason the court didn't want to deal with that challenge is because the CEO of the company, having claimed deep, heartfelt religious convictions in an interview later with Salon Magazine, couldn't say what they were. And just sort of delivered a kind of libertarian, anti-government rant about Obamacare. But, you know, as he continued talking, it became pretty clear, I think, from the interview that this wasn't a genuine religious liberty claim. It was simply he didn't want to pay for this insurance. And, you know, one other thing that's just worth noting is the court heard a challenge earlier this term about sectarian prayer before town council meeting.
Right.
It was interesting to see how anxious they are about the proposition of micromanaging religion. So the only thing in some sense that made the court more nervous in that case than having religious liberty curtailed is the idea that the courts are going to step in and start deciding which religions are doing it right and wrong. That made them very nervous.
And again, we're up on a break here, and David, I'm going back to you here, but who in the court will you be watching in particular when this case is argued?
Well, you usually watch Justice Kennedy on cases like this, because he is very concerned about liberty, and the question, it seems to me, is whether he considers this to be an important liberty issue or not. So I would look first at him, and then probably second at Chief Justice Roberts.
And that's David Skeel, again, professor of corporate law at the University of Pennsylvania, currently a visiting law professor at NYU School of Law. Wrote a book called The New Financial Deal. Also with us is Dahlia Lithwick. She writes about the courts and the law for Slate. We have much more to talk about after this very short break, and I do want to get some more callers in at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or tweet me at Marty Moss Cohen. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY and presents Handel's inspiring Messiah with the Philadelphia Orchestra, Philadelphia Singers Chorale, and soloists. The Messiah of the season. 215-893-1999 for Messiah tickets or at philorc.org. Sunday, December 22nd, one performance only at the Kimmel Center, the Philadelphia Orchestra presents Handel's Messiah.
On the next Fresh Air, novelist and screenwriter Delia Ephron tells us about her older sister, Nora Ephron, who died last year. Nora was her writing partner and her role model.
Did you publish before she did?
I think Nora was published when she was born, but no.
Delia Ephron has a new collection of essays. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY. We know that children of alcoholics are 4 times as likely to develop substance abuse problems than others, and they're at risk for depression, anxiety disorders, parental abuse, and neglect. But dealing with the issues early in life could make things vastly better. On the next Voices in the Family with Dr. Dan Gottlieb, helping children understand alcoholism in the family. Today at noon, here on WHYY-FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Can a company have religious beliefs, or is religion just for people? That's one of the issues at the core of 2 cases a U.S. Supreme Court will hear this spring in response to the Affordable Care Act's requirement that corporations must offer their employees insurance that covers contraception. Again, talking with David Skeel and Dahlia Lithwick. We got a lot of callers here. Let me get, looks like Scott from Center Valley, Pennsylvania, to join us. And Scott, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I want to speak to the issue of how religious freedom is being defined in this case, because it sounds more and more to me, you know, and they make these arguments, they're defining their own religious freedom as the right to deny basic freedoms under the law to citizens who might not even share their beliefs. How can religious freedom be defined in that way? I mean, if you have a healthcare plan which can give you free contraception, you, for instance, as a Catholic, have the right, because of religious freedom, to not use it. Okay, you know, to exercise your religious freedom to not use something that's counter to your beliefs. But to say that it violates your religious freedom to deny that same right of freedom of choice to private citizens who might not even be Catholics, I mean, they don't require all their employees to be Catholic.
No, apparently.
They don't require all their employees to be religious. So, you know, how can you define religious freedom in this way?
And Scott, those are great questions.
That's my question.
And they're great questions. And Dahlia, let me give you a crack at it, and then to you, David.
I mean, I think they're great questions, and I think they're precisely the right questions. You know, when does your religious freedom step on my just basic rights as your employee? And you're quite right to say, you know, a company like Hobby Lobby that has thousands of employees who are not all of the same faith really does raise these questions. I mean, I think the simple answer, I think I'd leave it to David to tease this out more, but the simple answer is that these employers say, because I'm causing abortions when I purchase insurance for my employees and they go on to use birth control, things that I believe to be, you know, not just birth control, but something like Plan B or Ella, I am causing abortions, and that violates my religious conscience rights. The other thing that's probably worth just clarifying for a second, Marty, is that the Obama administration made a bunch of accommodations after the law was initially passed. So the first accommodation was to exempt expressly religious corporations like hospitals and churches, like we said. There was a second accommodation that kind of tried to create a circuit breaker between the employers in this case and the purchasing of insurance by saying, we'll put it onto the insurance companies, not onto the employer. So the employer is no longer providing insurance, the insurance companies are doing that, and still these corporations, these religious corporations, objected. So the Obama administration really tried to accommodate the concern these drugs are causing abortions by creating another wrinkle, another sort of loophole that would have meant, in effect, that this is just an accounting thing now. And still, Hobby Lobby and Conestoga say, nope, we are still causing abortions.
David, can you... clarify some of that for us? Go ahead.
Sure. Well, I thought Dahlia put it very nicely, and I'll just say a couple of quick things. One is, I do think the tension and the difficult trade-off, or the difficult irreconcilable issues, are employers' perspective that if they have to provide plans that provide these kinds of contraceptions, that they're causing abortions. That's one right. The opposing right is the right of employees to have access to the contraception. And so there really is a tension between the employer's perspective and employees' potential perspective. The other thing I would say is just to say again that I think it's important to keep two different issues separate, and that is, the first issue is whether a for-profit corporation can have religious freedom rights, and in my view, the Supreme Court is likely to conclude that they can. The second issue is the issue that we've been talking about. The second issue is the issue of, does the government have a compelling interest in assuring everybody has access to contraception, which is the RFRA argument? Or more generally, when can religious freedom rights be overridden by a generally applicable law? So we're really focusing on the second issue of, ought employers be required to provide this coverage even if they do have religious freedom rights?
Let me get John from Collingswood to join us on Radio Times. And, John, go ahead. You're on the air. Do we have?
Yes, hello.
Yeah, John, go ahead.
Okay. Hello, yes. I just wanted to make a comment because you had mentioned that I'm a Christian Scientist who used to be a for-profit business owner. And with our employees who are non-scientists, we would always be sure to consider their practices, and we would never impose our own religious beliefs on employees. And I think that's generally true. I know it's quite true among all the Christian Science business owners that I know, and I think even employees who work at the church headquarters in Boston have many options for healthcare plans. So I think we should consider that. I think many reasonable people, and particularly those who, you know, have compassion for their employees, would allow that kind of flexibility, and for their employees who are not members of the religion. I think there's that distinction between those who are members of the religion and those who are not. And even in Christian Science, I know people sometimes think it's sort of a rule that we not use medical means, but it's not at all. It's each individual's choice. So I just wanted to make that point.
No, I'm really glad you did, John. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And David, since you're a corporate lawyer, I'd just be curious about your response to what John just told us.
I think that's extremely interesting. And my initial reaction is, I do think it's really important to pay attention to the way businesses accommodate to these issues and not always assume that the Supreme Court is the ultimate word on this. So that if a religion were to do, or if a religious corporation were to do outrageous things, there would be a lot of pressure against them in the marketplace that may change what they end up doing. And it's also the case that many religions may completely buy into the Health Care Act. So it's important not to get too caught up in the legal issues, or at the least to consider what's going on out in the world in addition to the legal issues.
John, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. And again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Dahl, you had a really interesting piece recently talking about this expanding definition of personhood and the idea that a fertilized egg for some people is a person. And now we're talking about corporations as people too. What do you think is going on in this society that we're expanding this definition of personhood?
Well, I just think, you know, and I wrote the piece because I think it's always a worry when you strive to sweep in another non-person into a legal metaphor. And this is war by metaphor, and, you know, law operates nicely on metaphor. But I think, you know, and one of the things I was, in fact, flagged in the piece was that a group of animal rights activists were seeking to get a chimpanzee defined as a person for legal purposes in order to protect it. So, you know, this is not a right-left enterprise. The notion that, you know, these personhood bills around the country that are trying to say that the minute an egg is fertilized, that is a legal person with all the panoply of human legal personhood rights, you know, is happening at one hand. But I think, you know, trying to say that a chimpanzee is a person is happening, you know, on the left. And it seems to me, and I guess the point of the piece was just to say, you know, A, I think you're always in danger when you argue, you know, predicated on metaphors. But I do think that as you seek to call more and more and more non-persons people, for legal purposes, it starts to devalue actual human
actual
personhood.
People.
And, you know, I think that the worry is that the more you broaden the definition of personhood for all these different purposes, which may each and of on their own be virtuous reasons, but I think it starts to really call into question whether people are worthy of certain protections that, say, fertilized eggs and corporations and chimpanzees maybe don't warrant.
So whether people are people, too, I guess. Let me read an email from Christine saying if they do win, these would be the two companies, and are exempt from buying birth control, can they object to paying taxes for any other issue that they disagree with on religious grounds? And this, I guess, is getting ahead of ourselves, David, but nonetheless, it's interesting to think about what precedent would be set if the Supreme Court agrees with these two companies.
Well, I guess it would be a question of what you can do with your religious principles. Do they allow you to exempt your business from everything, from taxes to other obligations? And as we were talking about earlier, I do think there are a lot of line drawing issues here, but I think the really scary cases are easy cases. So I don't think there's any chance in the world that a corporation would be allowed to disclaim its obligation to pay taxes in the same way it was not an Amish business was not allowed to disclaim its obligation to pay Social Security taxes. So I think the worst horribles will not arise, but I do think there'll be some line drawing issues, and in some respects, contraception is itself a little bit of a line drawing issues. But the court has to deal with line drawing issues all the time. I think that's just the nature of living in a complicated, diverse culture of the sort we live in.
Let me see what Phil from Westchester has to say. Phil, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
All right. Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome.
Obama's political advisors, I think, failed him. For public acceptance of Obamacare, the law should not have included birth control. And it's not too late now to back out abortifacients from the law. This would give him much more public support. And I'll take your reply off the air.
Fair enough. Phil, thanks for the call. Dolly, I'm going to toss that to you.
I mean, I think that, you know, birth control, as, you know, you said, these are all FDA-approved methods. These are all methods that there's a pretty significant consensus in the scientific community that these do not cause abortions, that this, you know, whatever objectors may say, I think there's pretty widespread belief among, you know, the medical associations that these are not abortion-causing drugs. And as I said, 99% of women in America will have used some kind of birth control at some point in their life, many, if not most of them, for non-procreative purposes. And IUDs are unbelievably expensive, and the argument has gone, according to the administration, that birth control is preventive care. This is not Abortions were never on the table for purposes of this legislation. We're talking about birth control. And I think, again, I just want to loop back and reemphasize something I said at the beginning that's important. The fact that each of the religious groups that bring challenges draw the line somewhere else as to what constitutes an abortion-causing drug is part of the problem. It's not, something around which the medical consensus matters. These are matters of personal religious faith. So I think it's just a little bit dangerous to say all birth control is therefore suspect. We're going to have to draw lines. The American medical community has drawn a line, and it is a line that was, I think, honored by the administration when it passed the ACA, and it is a law. It is a line that they have tried to accommodate several different ways.
Let me get John from Trenton to join our conversation. And John, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi.
Hi there.
I'm calling from a church perspective. Church can impose its theology on the congregation. In particular, the Catholic Church, I'm a member of the Catholic Church, and they are against contraceptives and even abortion. They're pro-life, but they can't impose that theology on the congregation. And if they can't do it from a religious perspective, how is it that the corporation can be allowed to do that?
Well, it's an interesting question, John. David Skill, do you want to take a crack at that? We're almost out of time, but go ahead.
Well, I guess the way I'd respond is that the employers feel, if it were just the employee making a decision whether to use a particular type of birth control or contraception or not, I think there wouldn't be an issue, and a church can't impose its views on the employee. But what we have here is an employer that, because of the nature of the healthcare law, is required to provide certain forms of coverage. So it's not just what the employee is doing, it's what the employer is required to do. And these employers believe that they're being required to provide contraception that amounts to abortion.
Well, and Dolly, we're almost out of time here, but I mean, employers pay our salaries, and if they're paying for our insurance, can we do different things with the benefits that we get from our bosses?
Well, I mean, I think traditionally our bosses haven't been able to tell us which parts of our health insurance they deem appropriate and which they don't. And I think, one of the real concerns here, as we've said all along, is that if they can tell us they don't want us to have an IUD, or they don't want us to have the morning after pill, or even more perniciously, if we have to go in and explain why we want birth control to our employers and have them say, oh, well, if it's just to regulate your periods, that's okay. I mean, what a nightmare. And so I think this is a deeply, deeply worrisome. I think this is one way that I disagree with David. I think this is the worrisome case.
Well, I'll tell you what, you have helped us understand a very complicated case, and my thanks to both of you. Dahlia Lithwick, thanks once again for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you.
And she writes about the courts and the law for Slate. And David Skill, thank you very much as well.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. Professor of Corporate Law at the University of Pennsylvania, currently a visiting professor at NYU School of Law. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out much more about this program. And send us an email. Check us out on Facebook. Send us a tweet as well. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.